Well, thank you, Ross, and it's actually a little more than 30 years. Matter of fact, when Josh Swanson took over as a senior pastor here, he said, how long you've been teaching the Paradoxes class? And when I told him, he said, that was before I was born. So this is actually my 44th year, and part of my story was that I came to Christ through my astronomy, and became a Christian by signing my name at the back of a Gideon Bible at age 19. By the way, this weekend I found the Gideon Bible that I signed giving my life to Christ. It's been lost for a year. But we put up a bookshelf, and lo and behold, it showed up. So that's great. I still have that Bible. Cover's gone, however. Our dog chewed the cover off, which caused one of my sons to say that our dog is from the pit of hell because he's destroying the Word of God. But my other son had a more sanguine response: our dog is feeding on the Word of God. So, but now after I became a Christian in Canada, I tried to find a church. And every church I tried was either filled with people who didn't believe the Bible was the Word of God, including the pastors that were teaching, or it turned out that they were really excited about the Word of God, but they were a cult. And so I literally went 8 years without finding a church. In fact, when I was in Canada, I said, I guess I'm not going to find Christians in churches. Kind of a weird thought. I did find a couple in the medical school just before I left there to go to Caltech. And when I got to Caltech, I met an astronomer there. He saw me sharing my faith with an atheist astronomer from Australia. By the way, that atheist astronomer eventually did come to Christ. And I found out that in April, I'm going to be speaking in his hometown in Hobart in Australia. So I'm hoping to be able to make contact with some of his relatives. But there was a Christian astronomer watching me. Matter of fact, that Christian astronomer is the father of this gentleman sitting right over here. I remember when you were just 8 years of age. So watch him grow up, and now he's a very successful engineer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So so thank you, Steve, for that contact. But it was your dad that said, this is not Canada. I can show you six outstanding churches just within the Pasadena area alone. And I said, well, give me the names of those churches. So he wrote all the names down, and I went to those six churches, and it was this church that I chose to attend. So believe it or not, this is actually the first church where I ever got involved. And the reason I chose this church, first Sunday I walked in, I saw this man in a three-piece business suit, very nice suit, and he was holding a hymnal with a guy with a dirty white t-shirt, bare feet, and jeans and long hair. And they were about 25 years separating the two of them. But they were clearly best friends. And I said, the only thing they've got in common is Jesus Christ. So this is a church where I want to be involved. It's also a church of the six. This is the church that was most active in going out into the community and reaching adults for Christ. So I began to attend this church. And 7 months after I started attending, they asked me to launch an adult class. And this is the class. So I've been teaching it ever since I was in my 20s. And this is now my 44th year. It'll be 45 years come September. So we'll see. So, yeah. So that's a little bit of background. Now, while I was at Caltech, I ran into this young man. He was a graduate student. And I had an office just by the library. And what I noticed is this graduate student, every Saturday afternoon, would have a special class for junior high students that he pulled out from all of the different communities around here. It was basically an astronomy enrichment class for any junior high student who wanted that enrichment. And so he did that faithfully every Saturday, totally as a volunteer. That impressed me because, you know, graduate students at Caltech, there's a huge stress on their time, and yet he made it a point to devote every Saturday afternoon. And we're talking 3 or 4 hours. He would give a talk, and then he would engage them on whatever questions that they had. Matter of fact, I got a lot of ideas watching him on how to launch this Paradoxes class, just watching how he did it. And He has since got his PhD at Caltech and moved on. He's been a professor at Harvard University for many years. But we spent quite a bit of time with him because, we would, what happened there at Caltech is on Sundays and Saturdays, we would go out and do little outings. And I remember one time we went up into the Azusa Canyon, and because all these astronomers from different countries said, "We heard there's gold in them there hills." And I said, "Well, there's not very much. You're going to work all day and get a couple of grains." And they said, "Let's do it." So, and then this guy from Australia that I knew, another astronomer from Australia, said, "Hugh, why don't we build a sluice box? That way we'll get maybe 15 or 20 grains of gold instead of just one or two." So we took the sluice box up there. But this young man, the grad student, Richard Krishner, came with us. And he and his wife had a great time working with us. And yet I think we got maybe 15 to 18 grains of gold. But that was for all day with a sluice box. So there is gold there, but not a whole lot. Quite different from what I remember when I was at the University of British Columbia, where undergraduates would actually pay for all their tuition and expenses by taking gold out of Boston Bar in the Fraser River. And that's when it was only $32 an ounce. You could literally pay, I mean, it was a good 40-mile drive to get out there, but you could actually get enough gold off the sandbar to pay for your university education expenses. Of course, back then, tuition was $526 for two semesters. I think the price has gone up a little bit since then. A little bit, right? So, but the reason why I'm mentioning this is that the young man at that time, Richard Kirchner, has now become a famous astrophysicist. And he spent most of his time at Harvard. He's still at Harvard, and probably best known for doing research on supernova. He's written the textbook that graduate students study to take a course in supernova. But his real specialty is galaxies that are very far away. And that was kind of the same thing I was working on when I was at Caltech. But he coined a term that I want to talk about based on some new publications that just came out and also new images. And he talked about how the universe has an end of greatness. Now, that term may be familiar for those of you that are hockey fans. I mean, if you're a hockey fan, there was one hockey player that was called the Great One. Do you know who that is? Yeah, it's Wayne Gretzky. He was called the Great One. And when he retired, the response in the hockey community, that will be the end of greatness. There'll never be another player like Wayne Gretzky. I mean, he's the only player that scored 6 goals in one game. I mean, 3 goals in one game is considered quite an achievement. In one game, he got 6. In one season, he got 94 goals. I mean, nowadays, nobody gets 50. And he actually has scored more assists than any other player has in total points. And basically, he holds like 45 or so records and basically say they'll never be broken. And they call that the end of greatness. But Robert Krishner, years ago, published a paper where he coined the term the end of greatness with respect to the universe. And actually, I'm going to turn around and call it the beginning of greatness. Because they called it the end of greatness because as we astronomers look farther and farther away, we reach a point where this amazing design of the universe seems to disappear. But if you start with the beginning of the universe and move forward, it's like this fine-tuning, amazing design that makes life possible. It gets more and more spectacular. But there's a particular moment where you see this dramatic change in the structure of the universe. And that's what Robert Kirchner called the end of greatness. So I got a few slides in this I'm going to take you through, and then I'm going to follow that up with an exercise for all of you. So I'm going to kind of take over here, but I want to get the rest of you involved with something that I've seen happening in social media this past week. And I think it'd be a great exercise for the class. Now, if you want background in it, you'll see this in the 4th edition of The Crater and the Cosmos. And incidentally, we're giving away free chapter 15 in that book. And that's the chapter that talks about the fine-tuning of the universe. However, what I'm going to be sharing with you today is so new, it's not yet in the book, but some of it is so old that it is in the book, and that's the stuff that Robert Kirshner was talking about. So let me kind of launch into this. And this is a map I showed, several months ago when it was first released. So this will be a review for some of you. And what you're seeing here, let me back up one. Well, what's happening here? Let me fix this. Ah, I see the problem. So I'm going to... Sorry, this did get fixed earlier this morning, but somehow it got unfixed. Yeah, that happens. After all, the universe is dominated by thermodynamics, which affects everything, right? So now I got to reverse the entropy in my talk. My apologies. Okay, now we're good to go. Okay, let me pull this back up. Okay, what you see here is the structure of the universe on the very largest scales. And all those little white dots you see there, those are not stars, they're not galaxies, they're not galaxy clusters. They're super clusters of galaxies. So, and I think by the time you're done with these next few minutes, the slides and video clips I'm going to show you, it's going to be kind of a mind blower at just how vast the universe is. So yeah, all that stuff you see there are super clusters of galaxies. That little red dot that you see there, that marks the location of what they call the local cluster of super galaxies. So that little red dot there represents a region where we got a huge number of super clusters of galaxies. And if you're not familiar with the term, a supercluster is a cluster of clusters of galaxies. And a supercluster is a cluster of super clusters of galaxies. Get the point? All right. And that's what you're really looking at there, superclusters of galaxies. But what Robert Kirshner pointed out years ago, when you look at that, you see that on the very largest scales, the universe is homogeneous and uniform. And it must be homogeneous and uniform on the largest scales just to make possible the existence of stars and galaxies and planets. And so if you make the universe slightly less homogeneous and uniform, you get nothing but black holes and neutron stars. If you make a little bit more homogeneous and uniform, you get nothing but gas in the universe. And so the homogeneity and uniformity must be very high when you're looking at the universe on extremely large scales, but even there, it must be fine-tuned. Too much uniformity and homogeneity means you get nothing but gas. Too little uniformity and homogeneity means you get nothing but black holes and neutron stars. Either way, you don't get life. And incidentally, what you see in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, that level of homogeneity and uniformity on the largest scales that we can observe must be extremely fine-tuned. And in fact, it's amazing that we live in a cosmos that's got stars and galaxies. It's far more probable you get nothing but gas or you get nothing but black holes. Instead, we're on that knife edge where we get galaxies, stars, and planets. And what you're looking at here is the entirety of the observable universe. This is all the universe we can see through telescopes. Now, it's not the entirety of the universe. The universe we see through telescopes is the universe of the past. So the farther away we observe, the farther back in time we see. The observable universe basically takes you back to 13.8 billion light years. That's as far away as we can look, because that's the age of the universe. So we can't see anything beyond that. But the universe is expanding. So the universe of today is larger than the universe we see through the telescope. Because we look back in time, we're looking at the universe when it was smaller than it is today. So the diameter of the universe would be 13.8 billion times 2. However, the universe of today we can calculate by knowing the cosmic expansion rate. And it turns out to be, 47.5 times 2. That's about 95 billion light years across. So that's the universe that exists today. But the universe we see through the telescopes is what you see there. Okay. The whole point is, on extremely large scales, we see that it is homogeneous and uniform. But as we look at a smaller portion of the universe, and this particular slide we're zooming in, so now we're looking at just the one region of the observable universe, and the little red circle you see there, that denotes what we call the outer neighborhood of the local superclusters of galaxies. A little red dot again indicates where we have what's called the local superclusters. But then you see the structure all the way around. Now, as you begin to look at the universe at this scale, you notice that the uniformity and homogeneity is beginning to transition to kind of a motley effect. If you look carefully at this, looks like you can see little circles of where you got galaxies and stars. But the other thing you notice is that we happen to be in a safe zone. The really big super clusters of galaxies, that would be the big bright white splotches, none of them are close enough to the local super clusters of galaxies to pose a gravitational threat where the gravity would actually be disturbing the structure of the local super clusters, or they'd be pouring out such deadly radiation. I mean, the big black holes that exist in these superclusters of galaxies actually throw up deadly radiation that doesn't just make life impossible within their region, but all the other superclusters around them. Okay, the next slide, we're actually zooming in to the nearby neighborhood of the local superclusters of galaxies. And here you begin to see a little more of the departure from homogeneity and uniformity. And that's exactly what Robert Kirshner called the end of greatness, where the homogeneity and uniformity gives way to amazingly fine-tuned structure. We got a question back there.
So if you just perspective, how many galaxies are there in each one of those dots?
Well, a typical cluster of galaxies might have anywhere from 1,000 to 5,000 member galaxies. And then you've got a supercluster, which would include something on the order of 10 to 50 of those kinds of clusters of galaxies. So now we're talking a lot of galaxies just in the supercluster. And notice how many superclusters we saw in the observable universe. We're really looking at about 50 billion trillion stars total, just in the observable universe. Of course, the universe of today would have more. Now,
you?
Yes, question here.
Just a quick question. When you say local supercluster, is that where we are located?
Yeah, we're inside the local, okay, we're in a supercluster called the Lanikaia supercluster, but the little red dot there actually shows the location of a whole bunch of superclusters of galaxies that we call the local superclusters. And so a little red dot is basically showing a region of about 30 superclusters of galaxies. But we're inside that supercluster, and then we're in a cluster inside that cluster. Anyway, you'll get to see the structure there. Okay. Now, I'm going to show you a more detailed map. This is basically showing the locations of these superclusters of galaxies, but it doesn't really reveal where the gas is or where the galaxy clusters are. It's just showing you the superclusters. This particular image here, we're actually looking at clusters of galaxies, not just superclusters. So that big bright dot there, that's a supercluster of galaxies, the biggest supercluster. The brighter dots are also superclusters. But what you get to see are clusters of galaxies, but they call this the cosmic web, because it looks like a spider web, or more accurately, what this looks like is a big set of soap bubbles. I mean, have you ever kind of, you know, got some soap together and you make this foam and you see all these bubbles? That's really what the universe looks like when we look at it on smaller scales. Or I could show you this image here, which basically kind of gives you the soap bubble effect. And what we see here is that we have these galaxies and clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies on the surface of these bubbles. So, you know, think of soap bubbles. What you have are these bubbles of soap, and inside the bubbles, there's nothing. Well, likewise, that's what we're seeing here, is that you've got these galaxies and clusters of galaxies, the gas and the dust, they're on the surface of these bubbles, and inside these bubbles, we have what are called the giant voids, where you really don't have much. Although, technically you do. Now, what I'm hoping to, does anybody know the password for the internet here? Because if you do, I'd like to show you some video clips of what it's like to travel through these cosmic webs. Does anybody know the, you do?
Christchurch.sm exclamation.
All right, let me see if I can get online here. Okay, Christchurch guest.
Capital C, C, 2C.
Well, you know what? Maybe I'm already on because it's not asking me for a password. Let me see if this works. Hey, I think we're in business. All right. And this first clip is only half a minute. And so I got two half-minute ones I'll show you. And let's see if I can, oh, come on. There should be a way to enlarge it. Where's full screen? Outside the window? Oh. Wait a minute, something happened here. No. This something happened here. No.
That's because of the enormous, almost unbelievable interest that investors like you have in the marijuana.
Oh, we don't want marijuana here. All right. I didn't find my cursor. Here we go. Here we go. Now I can get full screen. Hey! It's probably audio. But you're now, no, you're not going through galaxies, you're going through the cosmic webs, these little soap bubbles of galaxies, galaxy clusters, gas and dust. So, I mean, talk about a spaceship through the universe, right? Okay, that was 30 seconds. Let me get you another one.
The Milky Way galaxy is our cosmic home, but it is far from being the only galaxy in the universe.
Okay.
To get a better understanding of the composition and evolution of our universe.
Come on. How do I get out of this? Escape, that's what I tried. Well, okay, maybe, this should get me out.
The Milky Way can be seen as a glowing band across the night sky.
stop now? I don't want to stop. Right here? There we go. Oh, I lost the full screen. Come on. Yeah, there's another short clip. Yeah, it looked better if I can get the full screen. Here we go. There you go. Okay, what you're looking at, astronomers have actually created detailed maps of galaxies, galaxy clusters, and cosmic gas, and basically animated it. So it's actually based on real measurements. Okay, the one that gives you the most detail is this one. It doesn't come with sound, but it does come with subtitles. And okay, now I need to escape, get back to. Back up here. Oh, that's an ad, I think. Skip ads. This one's very popular, so that's why it's got ads with it. Here we go.
Tiniest dots here in galaxies.
Hey, Hugh, what does that MPCH mean?
Oh, that's megaparsecs divided by the inverse of the Hubble constant, which is the favorite distance scale that astronomers like to use.
Oh.
I'm going to translate that into millions of light years for you. To give you an idea, each of those bubbles is about 700 million light years. It shows you the evolution of the universe in this very way.
You.
Shirley Man didn't eat a lot of meat. She actually ate shellfish and seafood if we were going to eat animal protein. We did, for a time period, use animal meat. Very true. But those animals were actually eating grass and leaves. They weren't eating.
We did that. Let's go back in here.
Whoops. Here we go. Okay, this, let me get this back up. Here we go. This particular slide is been produced by a team of astronomers, basically showing how these bubbles formed and why these bubbles are so crucial for life to exist in the universe, especially advanced life. So that's basically what you're looking at in those fly-throughs of the cosmic webs. They call it a spider web, but it's really a better analogy, a whole bunch of soap bubble-like features. And this basically shows you the formation of these bubbles. And what's happening here is that the universe has both ordinary matter and dark matter, what we used to call exotic matter. And ordinary matter, matter that's made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons, has the property that it strongly engages light. It engages the photons. But we have 5.5 times as much dark matter as we have ordinary matter. And the dark matter has the property that it is very weakly interacts with light or doesn't interact with light at all. Now, so as the universe expands, we have this matter and dark matter expanding out from one another. But what happens is, as it expands, you're actually having the universe expanding at a just right rate so that this matter is actually able to condense in places. And so you've got this gas being blown out, but you actually have places where the matter is condensing. And that's what forms these galaxies, and the galaxies cluster together to form galaxy clusters. The galaxy clusters cluster together to form superclusters of galaxies. But when the ordinary matter collapses to make stars and galaxies, because it strongly interacts with the photons, it radiates light. And so what you have, for example, with the sun is gravity causing the sun to get smaller and smaller. But then you've got the photons being radiated out from the sun because it's made up of ordinary matter, and that radiation causes the sun to get bigger and bigger. So what you see with stars is a delicate balance between gravity, which is trying to crush the star, and then the electromagnetic radiation, the photons that are trying to make the star bigger. And right now, the sun is in balance. The photons are trying to make the sun bigger at the same rate that gravity is trying to make it smaller. And incidentally, that's crucial for us. If that was not the case, we wouldn't be able to live here on the planet. And if you wait long enough, you say, what's long enough? Well, about 4 billion years from now, the photons are going to start getting an advantage over the gravity. And that's when the photons start actually making the sun bigger and bigger. In fact, a time will come when the sun will be so big that the diameter of the sun will be larger than the orbit of the Earth. You say, what happens to the Earth when that happens? We get incinerated. Okay, the Earth will literally be vaporized when that happens. So you might want to take that into account in your investment strategies, that about 4 billion years from now, this planet will no longer be able to sustain your portfolio because of the fact that photons are going to get the advantage over gravity. Well, this actually applies not just for stars, but for any condensation of ordinary matter. And that explains why you get these bubbles. Because what happens is that you get pressure from the formation of these galaxies and clusters of galaxies of ordinary matter. And because these galaxies, when they form, begin to radiate light. That causes a pressure that basically forces the ordinary matter to reside on the surfaces of these bubbles. That explains why we see the ordinary matter all situated on the surfaces of these bubbles. It's a direct result of the pressure that is released by the engagement of the ordinary matter with the photons. You say, how do you explain the stuff that's in the middle? Well, the exotic matter does not engage the photons hardly at all, if at all, and hence it's immune to the pressure. And so the pressure from the photons has no impact, no effect on the dark matter. And so the dark matter stays in the middle of the bubble. And because there's 5.5 times as much dark matter as there is ordinary matter, the gravity from that dark matter actually is able to pull some of the ordinary matter in towards it. And so you get two places where the ordinary matter exists, in the center of the bubble, as a direct result of that being the location of most of the exotic matter or dark matter. It pulls some of the stuff towards it in spite of the fact that the pressure is pushing almost all of the ordinary matter out to the surface of the bubble. And so this basically shows you the structure of the different bubbles that make up the cosmic web. Now, what controls the size of the bubbles and what controls how much ordinary matter resides on the surfaces of these bubbles are three things. One is the bubble size is controlled by the ratio of the quantity of ordinary matter to the ratio of the quantity of dark matter. Now, I've already told you that when we astronomers make measurements, there's about 5.5 times as much dark matter as there is ordinary matter. Turns out that's crucial for determining the sizes of the bubbles. So for example, if you made the ratio of ordinary matter to dark matter bigger, that would make for much bigger bubbles. Or make it smaller, you get smaller bubbles. And the other factor you need to take into account is how much ordinary matter you have, because the more ordinary matter you have, the more pressure you're going to get from the photons. And so the total quantity of ordinary matter is a factor, and also the total quantity of dark matter is a factor. So the quantities of each must be fine-tuned to get bubbles of just the right size, and the ratio has to be fine-tuned to get bubbles of the right size. Then you also have to fine-tune the cosmic expansion rate, because this is all happening in an expanding universe. And so the expansion of the universe has an impact on the size of the bubbles. The universe expands, that's going to make the bubbles bigger and bigger as they expand. And what is it that controls the cosmic expansion rate? Two factors. The total quantity of matter, that means you add up all the ordinary matter and all the exotic matter, put that together, and what happens with matter, all matter, whether it's ordinary or exotic, has a gravitational pull associated with it. So the more matter you have in the universe, the stronger the gravity will operate. And what does gravity do? Gravity causes bits and pieces of matter to come together. And the more matter, the more powerfully matter will coalesce. And that actually acts as a brake on the expansion of the universe. So the mass of the universe is kind of like the brake in your car. It slows down the expansion of the universe. But as the universe gets bigger and bigger as a result of the expansion, that brake becomes weaker and weaker. And so gravity today is less capable of slowing down the expansion of the universe than it was when the universe was young and hence smaller, where the bits and pieces of matter are closer together. But today we know that the dominant factor controlling the expansion of the universe is dark energy. And that's energy that's embedded in the space surface of the universe. It's not like light. It's not electromagnetic. There's no heat and there's no light associated with dark energy. It's completely independent of electromagnetic radiation. It's radiation embedded in the space surface of the universe, and it operates so as the universe expands and the space surface, and here we're talking about the total space surface, not the surface of the bubbles, but the total surface of the universe. The bubbles are all associated on the surface of the universe. But as that surface gets bigger and bigger, dark energy becomes progressively more and more powerful to accelerate the expansion universe. In order to get bubbles of the right size to make life possible, you need the expansion of the universe to be highly fine-tuned at different points throughout the history of the universe. Now, a lot of astronomers tell you that the expansion of the universe is constant. It is constant to within about 1 or 2%. But the universe actually expands more rapidly now than it did when it was only a couple of billion years old. So it's a very slight variation in the expansion rate of the universe, and it turns out that must be fine-tuned to get bubbles of the right size at the right time to make life possible, and especially to make advanced life possible. Question here.
To help my perspective, everything you showed us, all the galaxy clusters and everything, did all that begin as a near infinitely dense and infinitely small singularity?
Yes. Okay. What I did not show you is the very early history of the universe. So the universe begins with all the matter and energy squished into an infinitesimally small volume. And then it expands. And at about 10 to the minus 35 seconds, it hyperexpands. That's called the inflation event, where the universe goes from the size of a fraction of the diameter of a proton to the size of a grapefruit in less than a trillionth of a second. That happens, and then it continues to expand at a normal rate there. And as it expands, you begin to get these hot spots and cold spots. And these hot spots and cold spots become the future that basically evolves into the web. And so, but you don't see that until the universe is actually millions of years old. Then you begin to see these web-like structures forming. Yes. Yeah, you got it. Well, that's kind of why I showed you the video clips, to kind of give you a mind-blowing feel of just the immensity of the universe, but also to give you a mind-blowing feel that, you know, we think that the universe is structureless on large scales. It's not. It has a highly fine-tuned structure of what we call sheets and filaments of gas and dust and galaxies, galaxy clusters, and superclusters of galaxies, as such that the universe, and incidentally, you say, well, how big are these bubbles? They're hundreds of millions of light years across. And to give you some idea, the Virgo supercluster that we are on the outer edge of, that's 50 million light years away. So I'm actually going to zoom in a little bit and let you see that. But my whole point is, these are the primary factors, not the only factors, but these are the three primary factors that determine the shape, namely that you're going to get kind of a spherical bubble, the shape, and then the sizes of these bubbles and what exists on the bubbles, namely that you get on these bubbles, you get a lot of the ordinary matter on the surface of the bubbles, and then you get a little bit of matter at the center of the bubbles because of the fine-tuned ratio of dark matter to ordinary matter. And the bottom line is, in astronomy, this is where we see the greatest measurable evidence for fine-tuning design, which is why Robert Kirshner called this the end of greatness. Because once you get past the early history of the universe, we see this spectacular, amazing, fine-tuned design, and the design becomes more and more spectacular as you move forward in the history of the universe. Which is why at the beginning I said, maybe we need to turn the thing around. Start at the beginning of the universe, then we can call this the beginning of greatness. And now the greatness gets progressively more and more spectacular in its capacity to make our existence possible. Okay, what I want to do here is zoom in from these big bubbles to show you the, and incidentally, you get the big bubbles, then inside, because it's kind of like what you see with soap foam. With soap foam, you get big bubbles, and then what you see is little bubbles associated with the big bubbles. And when I showed you those video clips of going through the cosmic webs, that's what you saw. Some of the bubbles were bigger than other bubbles. And we see that locally as well. So here we're going to zoom. Remember that little red dot that I showed you? I'm now going to zoom into the center of that red dot. So we're not just looking at this big thing of the universe, or just looking at that tiny little red dot? Yeah, question.
Does dark matter, has it been conjectured or anything known to condense into any kind of structures other than the dark matter? Like black?
Well, astronomers are studying this right now. Well, we know that dark energy exists. We know it's about 5.5 times more abundant than ordinary matter. Why? Because we can see the gravitational pull. I mean, the big quest in astronomy today is to find the particles that make up this dark matter. And so far we've found neutrinos. Neutrinos are part of the dark matter component of the universe. The problem is the quantity of neutrinos we see is just a small fraction of the total amount of dark matter that must exist there. So there's a quest going on in particle physics and astronomy to find the dominant particles that make up exotic matter. But neutrinos are an example. But they just make up a small fraction. And they have the property. For example, we call it dark matter because literally every day you've got trillions of neutrinos going through your body, you've got quintillions going through the Earth, and they don't disturb anything. They don't interact with photons, and so you might get one neutrino interaction in your body maybe in the course of your lifetime. Therefore, it's not a health risk, the fact that you're being bombarded with these trillions of neutrinos literally every minute of your life, because they just go through your body and don't do anything. Neutrinos go right through the Earth and don't do anything. Neutrinos float at the sun without engaging photons. In fact, when we look at the neutrinos coming to the sun, we realize those neutrinos are being produced by the nuclear reactions going on in the core of the sun, and they get out of the sun in less than a second. The photons take 100,000 years to get out of the sun, because those photons are engaging the protons, neutrons, and electrons. And so they're kind of doing this as they go up in the sun. It literally takes 100,000 years for a photon produced by the nuclear furnace of the sun to reach the surface of the sun. The neutrinos get there right away because they don't engage light. And so we're actually seeing radiation from the sun in real time that came from the sun 100,000 years ago, namely the photons, the neutrinos. We see what's going on in the core of the sun right away. And incidentally, it was that research that told us that we're living in the most stable luminosity phase in the entire sun's history. The sun is 4.57 billion years old. We're living within a 100,000 year window where, thanks to our study of neutrinos and photons, we know the sun is in the most stable phase it's ever been. And incidentally, that's the only time that human civilization would be possible. You have to be living within that tiny time window of the sun's history. But let me jump forward and actually show you the local superclusters. And so this is not our supercluster, it's a whole family of superclusters that exist. So that red dot I showed you earlier, we're now looking at all that little red dot, and you actually see there's a couple of dozen, if not more, superclusters in this particular image. That red dot represents the supercluster that we reside within. And now you can actually see some of the bubble structures, because you see these voids between the different superclusters of galaxies. Now, what you notice here is that these superclusters basically are big conglomerations of galaxies. They kind of look like footballs. Although, if you actually look at it in detail, these are huge sheets on the surfaces of the bubbles. But what you see here, they're very dense, gigantic conglomerations of clusters of galaxies. What you're going to see is that we happen to be living on a bubble where we're living in a supercluster of galaxies that we see nowhere else in the universe. We live in a unique supercluster of galaxies, and it's because of the structure of the local bubble in which we live. But this is kind of showing you what typically superclusters look like. Basically, looking at many clusters of galaxies jammed together in kind of a huge sheet where they're all just densely jammed together. But as we move in a little bit, so now we're beginning to look at the local part of the superclusters. So now we only see about a dozen superclusters here. How many of you were in the first service of this class? Okay. Remember they featured Mel Matthews with that little video clip?
Yeah.
Mel came to Christ in this class decades ago. And I remember when he walked into the class, I said, that guy really looks strange. He's a spitting image of Harlow Shapley. Harlow Shapley was the most famous astronomer of the early part of the 20th century. As you can see, one of these superclusters is named after him. That Shapley supercluster is such an enormous supercluster of galaxies, they're actually able to see it with a 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson here in Pasadena. And it was Harlow Shapley that basically discovered this and basically made the point, wow, we live in a really big universe where we not only have these superclusters, we got really big superclusters of galaxies. Turns out that Mel Matthews is the grandson of Harlow Shapley. So that's why he, I mean, if you look up photos of Harlow Shapley, you look at Mel Matthews, you really can't tell the difference. And you know, Harlow was probably most famous when he was in his late 50s, and now we got Mel at about the same age. They really do look remarkably alike. But even when Mel was young, I said, wow, that guy looks just like Harlow Shapley. So, and that's one of the bigger superclusters that exist near us. But as we move in a little closer, we actually see our supercluster. This is the Laniakea supercluster. And what you notice is how different it is from all other superclusters of galaxies. Your typical supercluster of galaxy would be kind of looking like a saucer, just jam-packed. Or if you look at it in three dimensions, it's kind of like a disk or a football, where all the galaxies are jammed tightly together. What's unique about our supercluster of galaxies, it doesn't look like that at all. It looks kind of like a spindly bunch of filaments. And we do see on these cosmic webs some of these bubbles where you see sheets of galaxy clusters, supercluster of galaxies. Then sometimes you'll see a filament stretching out of clusters of galaxies all in a line. What's unique about ours is you actually see these filaments. You don't really see the sheets, you see the filaments. Now as you move towards the Shapley supercluster, that's where you begin to see the sheet phenomena. But here we see that we live in a local cluster of galaxies where we have these filaments. You see a filament running from the center down towards the lower right, one running from the center down towards the lower left, and you see one running from the center to the upper left, and then you see one running directly to the right. So these are the filaments that radiate outward, and then this, and you can actually see the voids. So here we're seeing some of the smaller bubbles. You can actually see a void in the center, lower center, and off to the left, you see a void. Off to the lower right, you see a void, and the upper part, you see another void. So these are kind of the small bubbles of the cosmic web that exists in our local neighborhood. And in this particular slide, you actually get to see some of the individual galaxies that make up the clusters of galaxies and the superclusters of galaxies. The Virgo cluster is big enough that we call it a supercluster, although it's one of the tiniest superclusters that we can see. Now, the local group is situated along one of the filaments of the local supercluster. And as you can see, it exists in one of the least dense parts of the filaments. And where this is crucial for life, you cannot have life in one of these voids. In the voids, you do have galaxies. These little tiny dots that you see there are galaxies inside these voids. The problem is that you can't sustain a spiral galaxy in a void. Life is only possible in a spiral galaxy. By the way, most of the galaxies are what we call spheroidal or ellipsoidal galaxies. And most of those galaxies are past spiral galaxies that collapse. So you get a big spiral galaxy, and what happens is the spiral structure begins to collapse, and the whole galaxy gets squished into a much smaller volume. The problem there is the star density is now so high that it makes gigantic supermassive black holes in the core, and the stars are so close together they gravitationally disturb one another, and then you get blasted by the radiation from the supergiant black hole. Question.
Hugh, does that mean that we can eliminate entire superclusters of galaxies as candidates for life because of their structure?
Yes. I mean, you cannot have life in the Virgo cluster, for example. In the Virgo cluster, you've got thousands of galaxies, thousands of big galaxies, and tens of thousands of dwarf galaxies, and then you've got supergiant galaxies. And the supergiant galaxies in the Virgo cluster, and by the way, if you ever go to the Griffith Observatory, if you go down in the basement, they have an image with trillions of pixels in it. It actually is 100 feet long and about 8 feet high. And that basically shows you just one strip of the Virgo cluster of galaxies, a central strip. I mean, you can just spend hours there just looking at this incredible image, because it's a detailed enough image where it shows you not only the big galaxies and the giant galaxies in the Virgo cluster, it shows you the smaller galaxies as well. In this case, you're only looking at the big galaxies and the giant galaxies. But for example, there are galaxies in the Virgo cluster where they have supermassive black holes that are 7, 8, 9 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. And it's fortunate that we're a long ways away from the Virgo cluster, because, for example, there are several galaxies in the Virgo cluster with black holes bigger than a billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. And those black holes radiate deadly radiation. Radiation so deadly that they basically make the entire Virgo cluster uninhabitable. Basically rules out the possibility of life. And incidentally, we're barely far enough away from the Virgo cluster that advanced life is possible. Now, you could have maybe bacteria, say in that M101 group that's a little closer to the Virgo cluster, but you're not going to have advanced life. Matter of fact, the only reason why advanced life is possible on planet Earth is that the radiation from these supermassive black holes in the Virgo cluster presently is pointed away from us. If it was directly pointed at us, we would be toast. The bacteria would make it, but we wouldn't make it. But that's, you know, a couple of the design features of the Virgo cluster is it's far enough away where we're not being wiped out by the ones that are not pointed, but we're also fortunate, I would say fine-tuned, and that none of them are pointed directly at us. And of course, that's a problem for the Dorado group, the Leo group, and the Pavo group up ahead, is they all have these supergiant galaxies, and they have these very deadly black holes that are radiating radiation. But where we are, we're far enough away where that's not going to be an issue. But the problem with being in a void is that you don't have enough dwarf galaxies there to sustain the spiral structure. And when you don't have dwarf galaxies, what happens is your spiral galaxy collapses into a spheroidal or ellipsoidal galaxy. About 90%, in fact more than that, about 94% of all the large galaxies are spheroidal or ellipsoidal galaxies. Four more spiral galaxies that collapse. And you say, what does it take to keep the spiral galaxies going? Okay. In order to sustain the spiral structure, you have to sustain ongoing star formation. And how our Milky Way galaxy does that is that it has a regular diet of dwarf galaxies. Yeah, go ahead, ask your question.
Yeah, I was just curious how long all of these clusters have had their names?
Relatively recent. I mean, for example, when Harlow Shapley was the world's most famous astronomer, at the beginning of his career, he doubted that there was anything beyond our galaxy. And it took the building of that 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson to reveal, hey, our galaxy is one of many galaxies. Matter of fact, Harlow Shapley participated in a famous debate in the early part of the 20th century where he said, okay, I'm going to defend the position our Milky Way galaxy is a whole universe. And a younger astronomer defended the position that it's actually one of many. And incidentally, astronomers often feature these debates at their conferences. And it's not like the political debates or the debates that take place in Christendom. Basically, they volunteer to defend a position they're really not that committed to defend. But basically what Harlow said, you know, I'm an expert in these galaxies. I'm going to do everything I can to defend the position that our Milky Way galaxy is it. And these other things, these nebulae we see, are not galaxies. They're just part of our Milky Way galaxy. They're nebulae. They're gaseous nebulae. They're not huge conglomerations of stars. And he did really well in trying to defend that position, but he was thrilled to have lost the debate. Because this basically meant, okay, now we know something we didn't know before, and with a 100-inch telescope, they were able to make forward. And he was honored by having one of these gigantic superclusters named after him. And incidentally, that happens in astronomy to this day. And I think that's a healthy way for science to progress. And incidentally, we've done that a few times in this class. I don't remember how many of you were here when we had Ross Hoagland and Mark Perez do a debate on free will and predestination. And neither one of them were very committed to the position, but they basically volunteered, we're going to do the best we can to defend the position we've been assigned to and see where we go. And the wonderful thing about Mark and Ross when they did this debate in front of all of you, it's not either or, it's both. And that actually came out of this famous debate, as saying, you know, some of these nebulae we see really are part of our Milky Way galaxy, but most of what we see are actually galaxies, just like our Milky Way galaxy. And what really threw them is they thought galaxies were all spiral galaxies. The breakthrough of that debate, I think it was in 1917 they had that debate, was the recognition most galaxies are not spiral galaxies. And what happens when a galaxy stops consuming dwarf galaxies, then the spiral structure collapses. And so our Milky Way galaxy has been feeding on a regular diet of dwarf galaxies. Dwarf galaxies have the property that they're poor in stars and very rich in gas. About 90% of their mass is gas. And so when a galaxy like ours, a big galaxy, consumes one of these dwarf galaxies, it infuses a whole bunch of fresh gas into the core of our galaxy, which causes a burst of star formation, and it's a burst of star formation that basically sustains the spiral structure of our galaxy, keeping the stars far enough apart when you get on the other part of the galaxy that the orbits of planets about stars are not disturbed. The stars are far enough apart from one another where the radiation from the stars doesn't kill the life that could possibly exist on the planets. So life is only possible in a spiral galaxy. It's only possible in a large spiral galaxy that's got a small supermassive black hole. I was telling you that the big galaxies in the Virgo cluster have black holes in excess of 5 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. Our Milky Way galaxy is one that's just under 4 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. For the size of our Milky Way galaxy, its supermassive black hole is about 50 to 200 times smaller than what it should be. If you look at the Andromeda galaxy, which is the same mass as our Milky Way galaxy, its supermassive black hole comes in at 40 to 120 times the size of our Milky Way galaxy's black hole. And so that's one reason why you can't have life in the Andromeda galaxy, but you can have life in our Milky Way galaxy. Another reason why is our Milky Way galaxy has a spiral structure to make advanced life possible. The Andromeda galaxy's spiral arms look a little bit like ours, but the spiral arm structure is distorted, and you notice that the really big spiral arms are in the outer part of the galaxy, whereas you see that in our Milky Way galaxy, the spiral arms become less and less predominant as you move up from the center. The spiral arms in our Milky Way galaxy are well separated from one another, and the big factor is hardly any spurs and feathers between the spiral arms. You put spurs and feathers in there, now you've got radiation issues for life, and you also got gravitational disturbance issues. And so bottom line is, our Milky Way galaxy is the only spiral galaxy we astronomers have seen that's a candidate for advanced life. I think you, in one class,
we have one over here question? And one online.
And one online, okay, go ahead.
So let's say
We go out to Red Rock Canyon and we're looking up in the sky. From that vantage point, what are we seeing? I mean, do we see all those different large galaxies?
Okay, if you were to go out to a really dark place, let's say in the Mojave Desert or up on top of one of those mountains in the Sierra Nevadas, you would see one other galaxy with the naked eye. You will see the Andromeda Galaxy. You're not going to see it here in the LA Basin, but if you get in a dark enough spot, you can barely detect it with the naked eye. With a pair of binoculars, you can actually see its spiral structure. So it will fill a field of a pair of binoculars. It's about 9 moon diameters across in extent. But you're not going to see any other galaxies. That's the only one you're going to be able to see. So yeah, I mean, you'll see the Milky Way, and if you look at Andromeda, you'll see a very faint, small patch of light. That's the Andromeda Galaxy. All these other galaxies you see here, you're going to need telescopes to see them. But for example, a small telescope will show you about a dozen galaxies in the Virgo cluster. Why? Because those galaxies are supergiant galaxies. But yeah, you want to be in a large galaxy, but not a giant galaxy. You don't want to be in a dwarf galaxy, because you'll be gravitationally disturbed by adjoining galaxies. But the feature of our local group, yeah, there you see the local group. It's the smallest grouping of galaxies that we see anywhere within the Alinea Kaya supercluster. But it's a big enough grouping that our Milky Way galaxy has a diet of dwarf galaxies that it can consume every few tens of millions of years to sustain its spiral structure. So it takes this fresh, ongoing infusion of gas from dwarf galaxies to sustain the spiral structure. And of all the galaxies we astronomers observe, ours is the only one that has sustained symmetrical spiral structure for 10 billion years. And because it has, our Milky Way galaxy is unique and it can sustain 4 billion years of life history on one of its planets. And you need a long history of life. Ours is 3.8 billion years. You need that so the microbes to be able to transform the planet chemically and physically to make plants and animals and inevitably human beings possible. So anyway, that's kind of an overview of just the structure of the universe that makes possible the existence of advanced life. When it tells us in the Bible that heavens declare the glory of God, and the more we learn about the universe, the more evidence we see for the handiwork of God, thanks to people like Robert Kirshner and thousands of other astronomers, we're seeing, literally as every year goes by, more and more evidence for the fine-tuning design that makes existence possible in our local group and in our Milky Way galaxy. So yeah, go ahead.
We have one from online.
One online.
Yeah, Rick asks, has dark matter been observed or is it a concept as a conclusion of interference? Can the effect ascribed to dark matter be explained by other theories like plasma fields? And if so, would a plasma field explanation seriously undermine our cosmology apologetic?
Okay, very good. In competition with this model explaining this cosmic web as a result of gravity from the dark matter, the ordinary matter, and dark energy, there is a competing model in cosmology that says that the magnetic fields being exerted by the plasma in the universe, and basically plasma is a word for ionized atoms. So if you've got a bunch of atoms that have lost their electrons, that's a plasma. A plasma is a combination of nuclei that have lost their electrons and the electrons. And the universe is filled with this plasma, and where you get a plasma, you get the possibility of magnetic field generation. And so the plasma model was actually invented in the 1940s and 50s by Hans Alfvén, a Nobel Prize winner. And the theory has been actually in the literature ever since. However, the plasma model for the universe is now considered to be no longer viable. Why? Because in order for it to be able to explain these bubbles by electromagnetic effects as opposed to gravity, it needs the magnetic fields along those bubbles to be quite strong, in excess of a microgauss, and we've got measurements showing that they're weaker than a nanogauss. In fact, within the galaxies themselves, the clusters of galaxies, the intergalactic gas, the magnetic field is weaker than a billionth of a Gauss, and weaker than that. However, and I've got articles on our Weasens.org website. All you need to do is put in the search engine primordial magnetic fields. This is the idea that the universe gave birth to these magnetic fields as a result of gravity separating out from the other three forces of physics, and these fields persist to this day. And however, they do play a role, and that's one thing I said. I gave you the three predominant factors. There's a fourth factor, the primordial magnetic fields. They too determine the size and the structure of these bubbles that make up the cosmic web. But I didn't put it on the list because it's not as dominant a factor as the three that I mentioned. But it does have to be fine-tuned. And what you'll see in articles, my blog is called Today's New Reason to Believe. And I've written three articles on these primordial magnetic fields, basically saying we got measurements that tell us they must be at least a certain strength level, and we got measurements that tell us they must be a certain maximal level. And what's been really amazing in the last 2 years is that the lower limit and the upper limit are now beginning to come together. And as they come together, it's actually going to allow us to detect these primordial magnetic fields. Probably maybe like 1% of a nanogauss is where it seems to be coming in, which is exactly what we need to actually give us the bubbles that we observe. So yes, it is an important factor, but the plasma model basically says this is the dominant factor that governs the structure of the cosmic webs, and we know that is incorrect. It's not the dominant factor. It's a rather a minor factor, but it is a factor that needs to be taken into account. Okay, I had an exercise, and I'll tip you off as to what the exercise is because I've only got 4 minutes left, so we're going to pick this up next week, but I'm going to give you some preparation so you'll be ready. And incidentally, if you come back next week with more questions about the beginning of greatness, I'm thrilled to do that. And also some of you said, hey, can we have some time for questions? And what you talked about last week in Isaiah about drinking wine and beer. And if you didn't get that, it is archived on our paradoxes.org website. But I'll field questions on that as well based on a discovery that they've made on how much beer and wine we should drink or not drink. Okay. What I want to do as an exercise, what I've been getting on my Facebook and Twitter pages, and this is coming from both Christians and atheists. Okay, Reasons to Believe is famous, and this Paradoxes class is famous for giving you an overwhelming amount of evidence for God and the Christian faith. But they said, could you please just select out one? It says, and I just found out we had somebody survey our website at reasons.org. The new site and the old site, because we're actually building a new site that's going to take all the material from our old site and our new site, put it all in one place, and we're going to design our website so that power users can dig into our archive as deep as they want. And I said, well, how big is the archive? And they said, well, there's over 60,000 articles. I had no idea we had that kind of a database. Now I understand why I'm getting Christians and atheists basically coming to me and saying, there's too much coming out from Reasons to Believe. Just give us one piece of evidence. So that's something I want you to talk about and get ready for next week. Because I'm going to basically try to get you all engaged, saying, okay, if you run into someone, either on the street or in your family, in your neighborhood, or online, who says, look, just give me one evidence for the Christian faith. What evidence would you give him? Or how would you handle that question when somebody says, I don't want to hear 15 evidences. I don't want to hear 60,000 evidences. Just give me one. And so what would you do? Which one would you choose? Now then, I'm going to break this exercise up in several ways. Okay, what would you choose if you know the conversation's going to end in 1 minute? And we used to do a series at Reasons to Believe called Elevator Apologetics. You're on the elevator with somebody. You know the elevator ride's only going to last 30 seconds. What do you say when you got that opportunity? But I'm going to kind of expand it. If you got 1 minute, then if you got 10 minutes, and if you got an hour, which evidence would you choose? And why would you choose that? And then how would you respond to somebody who asks that question? Because sometimes the best way to respond to a question is to come back with a question. Okay, they're hitting you with that question. What question would you say in return? That's our exercise for next week. So now you've got a whole week to think about it. Because I think that's really better. I was going to just pop it on you right now, but I think it's better if I give you some time to think about it. So with that, let me close in prayer, and we'll see you next week. Father in heaven, again, we want to thank you for the privilege of you creating us at this time in the history of humanity, in the history of our earth, of the universe. Lord, where we are in such a privileged position to see the immensity of what you revealed to us through the book of nature. Thank you, Lord, that we are in that generation when our minds are being blown away with all of this new information and new evidence. And Father, help us to be able to take this explosion of fine-tuning evidence that demonstrates your existence, your personality, your love, your power. Lord, just the whole idea that you made such an immense cosmos just so that we could have this one planet on which we can live and thrive and serve your purpose. Lord, I pray that you'd be giving each of us throughout this next week opportunities as we engage our friends and relatives and associates to be able to share this news in such a way that would motivate them to seek more of your love, life, and truth. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.